Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny. This week, how humans evolved through fire, language, beauty and time. With Gaia Vince and her latest book, Transcendence. Gaia Vince is a science writer and broadcaster interested in the interplay between humans and the planetary environment. She has held senior editorial posts at Nature and New Scientist, and her writing has featured in newspapers and magazines, including The Guardian, The Times and Scientific American. She also writes and presents science programmes for radio and television. Her research takes her across the world. She has visited more than 60 countries, lived in 3, and is currently based in London. In 2015, she became the first woman to win the Royal Society Book of the Year Prize solo for her debut, Adventures in the Anthropocene, A Journey to the Heart of the Planet We Made, which you might have heard on Little Atoms about 5 years ago. Her latest book, Transcendence, How Humans Evolved Through Fire, Language, Beauty and Time, we're going to be talking about today. Gaia, welcome back.
Brilliant, lovely to be here.
Tell us what the idea behind Transcendence is.
Well, so as my first book, as you mentioned, was about the Anthropocene, the way that humans have changed the planet. This really was a quest to answer what to me is one of the biggest questions. You know, why did this one smart ape go on to change the world? How did we become the creature that created the Anthropocene? And so really it's about our transcendence. It's about how our evolution took a different trajectory from all the other creatures on Earth and followed this cultural evolutionary pathway.
And as we go through the book, you look at certain ideas, the book's in sections of certain ideas. For instance, art, and not necessarily like, you know, why humans do art, but how art has helped advance our evolution. And we'll do that as we go through the various chapters as well. But to begin with, I want to talk about, I mean, you just asked this question in your description there as to why it was that. One of the key things is our brain gets bigger at some point in hominid evolution. And so let's talk about ideas why our brain got bigger, but say a chimpanzee's brain didn't get bigger.
Yeah, well, that's a really big fundamental question, isn't it? Because all of what we see around us, this whole human world, depends on our brains, because that's where it came from. And I'll talk about really what that means, because it's not our individual smarts. It's actually the fact that we can rely on our collective brain. So it's us as a collective that have managed to produce all this. It's not you or I as individuals. But of course, that still relies on having a big brain. But a big brain is incredibly energy intensive. Mm. So if you think about the amount of fuel we need to keep our bodies going, well, a whole 20% of that calorific content is needed only for our brains. So in order to get to fuel this huge brain, we needed a lot of food. And if you look at what food was available at this time in the Pleistocene when we were evolving, well, you know, it's a bit of meat perhaps if we could hunt. I mean, we didn't start off by our ancestors didn't start off by hunting. We were mainly foragers, so a plant material or a little bit of meat. It's not a lot, you know, to get that calorific content. We would have had to spend all our time doing this just to feed ourselves. But actually, we used two tricks. So first of all, we relied on our group. So we didn't rely on just ourselves. We relied on our group. So that immediately you get this energy efficiency, because what we're talking about is energy. The reason that we've managed to achieve all this is because we harness energy better than any other life form. And that's really the trick to our success as a species. So in order to harvest the energy for our bigger brains, we needed to use another technology. Apart from relying on the group, we also had to rely on the external energy of fire. So cooking our food immediately gives us access to much greater calorific efficiency. We didn't need to eat so much to get the same bioavailability of those calories. But of course, we're not born knowing how to cook. So, you know, it's a bit of a chicken and egg situation. We had to learn how to do it. So our brains had to be big enough and evolved enough for us to be able to take that knowledge from something else, from our friends and relations around us, from our group. So the whole thing is a cooperative venture. We are this cooperative venture. We're not, you can't consider us as individuals. You have to consider us as part of this community, as part of this group effort, this group brain and the group, the physicality of the group as well. We don't hunt alone. So we're relying on the group to learn and how to cook our food, to learn how to hunt, to actually carry out the hunt physically and to feed ourselves. And that meant we could rely on the group. For example, when a mother is giving birth, she doesn't have to also hunt and she doesn't have to also supply all the needs that this big baby with a big baby brain needs, as well as her own needs. She can rely on the group to support her. In fact, the brain grew so big that it became very, very difficult to give birth, because we really reached that limit of what the mother's pelvis could expand to and still be able, and still for her to be able to run and hunt. And as someone who has given birth twice, I have to say that limit has definitely been reached and perhaps overstretched. And as a result, we rely on others to give birth. We're a species that cannot give birth alone. So we cannot feed ourselves alone. We cannot give birth alone. We're really quite an extraordinary species already, just looking at those things compared to chimpanzees.
Well, I did. I was going to use the giving birth thing as an example of, there are certain evolutionary things that happen to us that you might otherwise think were bad things that would work against us. For instance, you know, the narrowness of the birth canal and the hips. But also, one of the things you talk about is how our jaw evolved to be sort of, you know, much smaller, not the jaw of basically something that hunts with its mouth and eats raw meat, basically. And again, these things seem to be disadvantages in some ways, but obviously then coupled with the, you know, the idea of the collective, they started to, you know, started to help us evolve. I want to talk about other reasons why we got there, and I guess environmental changes that might have happened to very early hominids that basically also set us off down that path.
Yeah, so yes, we did. We evolved in a way that, considering we're predators, we're essentially apex predators, and we evolved in a way that our actual bodies, our biology, becomes worse. So as individuals, we're actually really poor hunters. And what we use instead, and which I consider as part of our bodies, is our technologies and also our cooperative learning and our cumulative cultural evolution, basically. So in the place of claws and jaws, we have obsidian knives and tools and slingshots and weaponry. And in the place of these jaws and enormous guts to digest our food, we have fire and cooking and those sorts of things. But how did this, what sort of triggered this? Well, I think it's really important and really very rarely recognised the role that environment played in our genesis as a species. So I call it the human evolutionary triad, and this idea that there is this co-evolutionary process between our environment, our biology, our genes, and our culture. And these three feedback mechanisms are really what has created humanity. It's what's created us. And so the role of the environment, for example, is really important in starting all this off. So we emerged from a forested ecological niche. That was our habitat early on in our ancestries. And then when the climate changed, it became drier, and we got these spells with open savanna, and the herbivore population increased. It became much more, there became much more easy pickings out there. It became lower energy process for us to get our food from the savannah. And so we became savannah hunters. We came down from the trees. Our anatomy changed and we became walkers, runners even. Our entire spine and body changed for that. We have this S-shaped spine, which supports running. We're able to run long distances. But hand in hand with this anatomical change is also the cultural change, which allowed us, for example, to plan ahead that we might need water and to carry water in pouches. So it's this that has given us this ability to outrun other species in endurance. So we sweat, but we replace our water. So we're able to outrun antelopes, for example, over many hours, whereas they collapse from heat exhaustion because they don't carry their own water.
I want to come back to fire. You mentioned, obviously, the fundamental idea that, you know, this helped us discover that we could cook food and therefore, you know, it was easier to digest. It's sort of hard to imagine that somewhere out there on the savannah there was like a hominid ancestor that first came across, and I presume, you know, a natural fire that had sort of devastated part of the landscape and killed some animals, and he stumbled across an animal and picked it up and it was tasty.
I mean, we found evidence for foraging early ancestors, basically coming across the charred remains mm-hmm. of natural fires and eating those kind of barbecued meats. And I guess what would have happened, I mean, fires would have been more likely anyway. And I guess what happened is that our ancestors learnt to seek those fires, and there's actually there are actually wild animals that do that. So there's a particular kind of corvid in Australia which starts fires deliberately. So it will look for a natural bushfire, and then it will carry a burning twig from that and start a fire elsewhere. Because when there are fires, you get small animals fleeing the fires, but you also get the charred remains. So it's an excellent buffet. And if birds can do that, it's really not a big stretch to imagine our intelligent ancestors doing that. But the trick really was learning how to start fire and to keep it going. And once we learned how to do that, and once we taught it to each other, we were an entirely different creature. We were something that had never existed before, and we were able to completely transform our landscape.
Just as an aside, this chapter begins with a little sort of scene-setting story of you driving through an Australian bushfire, which is incredibly prescient as to what's just recently happened. Tell us about what happened.
Yeah, so I'm half Australian, actually, so I've spent quite a lot of my life in Australia, and this was in northern Queensland, and it's happened a few times, actually, but the first time it happened, I was alone in the car, and it was terrifying, really terrifying, because it's the speed that you don't, if you're not used to it, it's really hard to understand how quickly a landscape can change. And obviously this was already speeded up because I was travelling down a highway, and at first I just noticed a little change in the colour of the landscape, a little bit of smoke, but I didn't really think anything of it. There are lots of sugarcane fields, which are quite easy to catch fire, but also the bush in Australia is very receptive to fire, the oily barks and the oily leaves. And so I was driving along, and suddenly I was engulfed, and I don't know what was the sensible thing to do. Should I have reversed back and tried to get... I didn't know what to do, and I was frozen in fear. And that stretch of being completely surrounded by this deathly presence, apart from my little cocoon of a car and the tiny bit of oxygen in that, was... It stayed with me, and those moments seemed to last a much longer period of time than they actually did. It must have been a few seconds. I put my foot down and outpaced it, and it was soon behind me. A lot of people are not that lucky, you know. I've been watching the news, and that might not have been the sensible thing to do. I don't know. Presumably what I should have done is get away from that. But it really, it's not very often in our day-to-day lives that we are confronted by the violence and the terror of the natural world. You know, it's not every day that we will face an aggressive predator like a lion, or a volcano will erupt, or there'll be a huge fire, although these are becoming more common. And so when it happens, you get this very primal terror, this real fear that something much bigger than your experience, your natural experience, is engulfing you. And it's really frightening. It's really frightening. And our ancestors would also have had fear of fire, but they learnt to use it, that power, that raw energy. And that's what it is. It's energy.
The book also contained one of those, to me, facts that, you know, it had never occurred to me. And it's quite sort of mind-blowing that not only was there a time before our human ancestors discovered fire or utilised fire, there was a time on this planet before fire.
Yeah, that's true. So fire requires three things: oxygen, a fuel, and a temperature that's hot enough for ignition to occur. And there was a time when these didn't occur. Right. So when the Earth was formed, there was very little oxygen in the atmosphere, for example. And it also took a long time before there was enough vegetation for anything to burn, because initially it just rained and we got the oceans. So there was no vegetation. It was wet and it was cold. And there are times when fires would have been really, really common, because there was a high temperature, high oxygen level, and lots of flammable things, and fires would have been incredibly common. And there was a time when fires would have been quite rare. We're living at the moment in a relatively cool period of time, but with lots of flammable things and 20% oxygen. So fires are not as common as they have been in the past, but they're common enough for us to use them. So we're really lucky that we evolved in a landscape where fire is even possible.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Gaia Vince, and we're talking about her latest book, Transcendence: How Humans Evolved Through Fire, Language, Beauty and Time. And Gaia, I want to move on from fire to storytelling, which is a good link, as storytelling tended to happen around the fire.
Yeah, so, and that still happens. Mm. If you look at analyses that have been done on people that still gather around fires, hunter-gatherers, and I mean most communities, it's only quite recent that we, you know, live in our radiator worlds with with a sofa and a television. Quite often the focal point would have been the fire, and those times of the day tend to be dominated by storytelling. And storytelling evolved really for two reasons. One is this community aspect, this idea of drawing people together. It's a really important tool for that. And you have to remember that our whole evolution is dictated by the strength of our community. So we are nothing if we are alone. We can't survive alone. You know, as we've seen, we can't create a fire, we can't feed ourselves, we can't even give birth alone. We depend entirely on our group, and the cohesiveness of our group, the strength of our group, gives us the strength that we have to survive as individuals. stronger our group, the more likely we will survive. So our survival depends on the group survival. So anything that boosts that is really important. And so storytelling does that because it gives this narrative that people relate to. It's a way of understanding other points of view, of making this group narrative that we can all identify with. But stories also do something else that's really important. They're a way of passing on our culture, our ideas, our technologies, our tools, our values. Important cultural knowledge is transmitted through storytelling. It's much more memorable than if it's just given to you as a stream of data. If it's embedded in a story, you understand and you remember it much better, and you're much more able to pass it on and much more able to remember it well to pass on, because all of our cultural knowledge, it has to be passed on, it has to be transmitted accurately, or you don't get that transmission over the generations. And evolution, cumulative cultural evolution is impossible unless you have that really accurate transmission. It's the same with our genes. You know, if we put in loads of mutations, and if we disrupt the way that genes are transmitted over generations, we won't get evolution because we don't get anything to select.
I want to come back to a really vivid example of one of those. I mean, the technique to grind bread, that a certain bread that the Aboriginal Australians use, which is something that, you know, could not have been stumbled across by one person and needs to be retained. But to get us to that, let's talk about the sort of incredible tradition of the songlines, which you talk about in the book, because, again, it's an incredibly vivid example of literally how the idea of the story has helped them to survive extinction.
Yeah, so Aboriginal groups, their culture is embedded in songlines, but not just their culture, their entire landscape. It's a navigation tool. So everything is understood, their ancestral history, the way they understand the stars, the way they understand the landscape, the way they learn all their techniques. Everything they do is embedded in songlines. These are stories that are passed down over the generations through the group. They're often sung. Each group has their own language, and the storylines are in those languages, but they also use easily understood phrases and that can be understood by other tribes. And this has really helped Aboriginal groups survive incredible hardship. If you consider that the first people arrived in Australia around 65,000 years ago, that was a completely different world. They dispersed, their cultures diversified in complexity, and they developed all different languages and all different cultures. But everything was kept in songlines. So these stories were passed down, and the cultural knowledge of where to eat, where the water holes were, how to make a fishing net, how to make nardoo bread, for example, from this it's a seed pod, actually, of a kind of algae, a kind of water weed. And all this knowledge is passed down. And when the environment changed, as it did, we got ice ages where there was massive drought, where the sea levels changed, and where food was really, really scarce. It was the songlines that contained within them this great diversity of knowledge. So they had knowledge of what to do in times when they might have found themselves near the ocean, how to fish, how to do that, even if they hadn't ever experienced that in their lives before. They had knowledge of where to go to find water in drought areas, and they were able to pass that knowledge and keep those transmission lines open between groups. Which was so important. Yeah, and we find the archaeologists have found the grinding stones from seed pods 12,000 years ago, you know. It's really amazing.
And this bread is basically fundamentally poisonous unless you carry out some quite esoteric
so
processes.
So all of these,
on it.
The importance of this knowledge, of cultural knowledge generally that's passed down, is that it's not... As individuals, we would not be able to know all the different things. If you look around you now, there is nothing that you would not be able to in your lifetime recreate the complexity of just what's in this one room yourself. The only way you could do it is if you're told and the tools are passed down and the materials and how to get it and all that knowledge and all of that, the complexity of getting the resources and assembling them and how it all works is passed down to you. And that knowledge has itself been selected over generations, just as genes have been selected over generations, so that you get this selective adaptation and the survival of the fittest knowledge, in other words. So Nardoo is a seed which is actually poisonous if you eat it raw. So in order to make bread, over generations, Aboriginal people have learnt exactly the technique of sluicing the Nardoo to get rid of this this poisonous enzyme, of grinding it, of sluicing it some more, of cooking it to a certain temperature, and all of that so that it becomes nutritious rather than deadly. And the chemical formula of Nardoo and why it kills you is not something that any individual Aboriginal ever knew or ever discovered. It was discovered incredibly recently, and yet it works because that knowledge has been passed down over generations. They don't have to know the reason it works, just this is the way to do it. This is the ritual that results in the bread, and this is how you make the bread.
Obviously connected to complex storytelling is the development of language as well. As another tool, that I want to talk about some ways in which language is one of the things that helped us on the way, and particularly in the way that, I mean, I guess as someone who's monolingual, it's sort of difficult to understand that there are languages that, you know, tonal, non-tonal languages you talk about, for instance, in which they change your whole sort of cultural outlook depending on the way that the language works.
Yeah, so that's something that I talk about throughout the book, the fact that we make ourselves. So when I was talking about these feedback loops between environment, biology and culture, they really do feedback. So the environment, the cultural developing bath, I describe it as, that you're immersed in since birth, really sets your neural pathways, how you see the world, how you behave, how you react, what you think of as normal, what you think is beautiful, or what your values are, what you think is disgusting or rude or important, or even the colours you see, all sorts of things. It's really quite strong. And language is a fundamental part of that. So in some languages, which are all languages as they evolve, and languages do evolve, have words for colours. And they start off with the words for black and white. And then normally there's the colour red is defined, given a word, probably because our blood is red. And then increasingly other colours crop up. We used pink, orange, all these different other colours. They essentially meant red until recently. They were not separate colours. But the colours that you name actually define your biology in a way, because it's the colours that show that it's the colours that you know. In cultures which name the colour blue, for example, people who use that are much better at discerning blue in a colour palette than people who don't have a word for it. And people whose culture defines different shades of black and white. So we have grey, black and white. Well, other cultures have many, many more shades that they define in between. And they're much, much better at discerning within a colour palette where the different shades are, whereas we can't see it. We just can't see it as well. And that moves across languages to, for example, I think we, in English, we're more likely to find a causative agent for something. So if there is a cup on the table and somebody knocks it off and it falls to the ground, we would remember that somebody knocked it to the ground. Whereas in Japanese, the cup would just fall to the ground. We don't need the causative agent. And so Japanese speakers find it less easy to remember who did the action. Yeah, so basically the idiosyncrasies of the language that we have evolved to, that have evolved to be spoken by us, completely change our outlook and the way that we see things, and we see that happening artificially as well, where people try and define things in order to draw attention to them. We have that at the moment going on massively within sort of gender identity, but it's also going on with various sort of ways that people feel or people are being discriminated against. It's very important to make those words known, because once those words are said, you think about them differently.
I want to talk about, again, something that doesn't necessarily seem vital to survival or to, you know, to our evolution, which is appreciation of shiny things, basically, trinkets, beauty, and like symbolic works of art. What part did, you know, when did these come along and what part do they play?
Yeah, so that's another way that we're very, very different from all the other animals, in that we attach symbolic value to things, which are subject. It's a subjective value. So we decide something is beautiful and we beautify things and we spend an enormous amount of time and energy.
And money
trying to make something beautiful that doesn't need to be beautiful. And, you know, if a hand axe is more beautiful than another hand axe, it's not going to be more effective. You know, a necklace isn't going to feed us. Gold is not going to keep us warm or protect us. And yet these are so valued in our culture. And that's really, it's really important. It's been a really massive driver of our evolution. Because once we agree as a group to attach value to something, it becomes meaningful, and we seek meaning and purpose in everything we do. We could die for our art. We imbue things with a value that they don't have an objective value, and that's just as important. And what it's meant is it's enabled us to reduce the energy costs of all sorts of transactions. So if you think that animals are basically limited to their ecological niche. They're limited by the resources they can obtain, whether that's the food they need to eat or the shelter they need to make. And when that runs out, well, bad luck. Whereas we can live very far from our ecological niche. Where I live, you know, I certainly don't rely on everything in my small square footage to provide me with food, energy, everything. Everything I have, I rely on my much wider group. And when I say the group, I mean the world, really. You know, I'm eating bananas from the Caribbean. I'm eating meat from somewhere else, or beans from wherever. So rice, energy, everything has come in. And so what we're doing is we're not obtaining our resources from where we are. We are able to obtain our resources from much, much further afield. And that happens through trade. And if you just had to swap, barter one thing for another, you're very restricted. Because, you know, you might want an axe to kill a buffalo, and then you give the meat to the person that gave you an axe, so you swap one for another. Well, that's all fine. But what about if there's no buffalo in the area, but you still need to eat? Well, you've got your axe, but the only thing available is potatoes. Well, the potato grower doesn't need an axe. So what are you going to do? So really, our love and the value that we place in these, in the subjective value we place in these essentially inert things like beads and trinkets, is incredibly useful to us, because we can use that as payment. We can use that to lower the energy costs, lower the risk involved. So if I've got an axe and I want to eat, and there's no buffalo, but there's potato, I can say, look, I will give you my beads, you give me the potato, and then later we can do a deal, you know, on buffalo meat or something. But those beads are a transaction, they're a deposit, they're an insurance policy. And so that enabled us to trade much wider with complete strangers, where you don't have to trust the person, you don't have to be sure that they'll make good on their transaction at a later date. You can use trinkets.
Just to finish us off then, you just talked about, you know, this idea that we are now a global group. You know, we source foods and energy from all around the globe. And you know, in the last book, we talked about the Anthropocene, the, you know, the time of humans, and the fact that, you know, we are, you know, physically changing our environment and changing the planet. And towards the end of the book, you talk about, you know, the connected world and where we're going, and a new species of man, for want of a better word, Homo omni. Tell us something about homni.
So evolution accelerates human cumulative cultural evolution. It relies on a population. So the bigger the population, the more cultural knowledge there is, the more technologies, ideas, and all those sorts of things are held by the group. And the better the connectivity means the more likely you are to connect with somebody who has another technology that can then you can then combine these ideas to produce a new one. So generally, over time, what seems to happen is the bigger the group and the greater the connectivity of the group, the faster the evolution, the more culture, you get these cultural explosions in complexity and diversity. And that's happened in the past. And right now, what's happening is this really extraordinary moment where we are entering this time where we have this enormous population of more than 7.5 billion, and we're more interconnected globally than ever before. So we can exchange ideas, we can exchange technologies, beliefs, and we're coming together with all these things, and we're getting this explosion in new products and new ideas. And at the same time, our environment is completely changing because of us. So I think that this is really an extraordinary time. I think we're hitting this tipping point in human evolution, and things are changing, and we are acting less as individuals, less as small societies, and more as this great big marauding super species, which really is changing the environment. And it's creating, yeah, the Anthropocene, the age of humans, and pushing us into this in this different direction. And so I call this superorganism Homo omnis, sort of all man, this kind of like really big idea. And so I shorten it to homni, and I think of it as a kind of as a toddler sort of blundering around. And at the moment, we don't know where we're going, and we're raising the temperature of the atmosphere, and we're throwing plastic into the oceans, and we're causing this great extinction and so on. But we're also producing a much safer environment for a lot of humans in other ways. So we have this incredible new agriculture and new medicine that keeps people alive and fitter much longer and much better. So all these things are happening at the moment, and I don't know where Homni will take us. But we're at the beginning of this, and it's a very unequal society. You know, some people really are at the very edge of Homni. They're kind of outliers on the outside of the network, very unable to, they don't have the agency to sort of shift the general sort of movement of this big superorganism. They don't have internet connectivity, or they struggle to feed themselves. They don't have enough fresh water. And others really are right at the center, and they have a lot more power, and they're much better connected. So to me, really, this is a dangerous situation, and we need to remember that through our history, humans have thrived because of the group and because of the diversity of the group. The diversity, and when I talk about diversity, I'm talking about cultural diversity, the different ways of thinking. You know, the Aboriginals who survived these great ice ages, which killed enormous numbers of species in Australia. They managed to do that because within their cultural knowledge bank, within those song lines, really were a great diversity of ideas, knowledge and beliefs. And whether it's to do with following the stars or knowing how to make seed pods. And that's what we're going to need as a global society, too, as a global superorganism. We're going to need all this different knowledge and all these different strategies.
So I've been talking to Gaia Vince. We've been talking about her latest book, Transcendence, How Humans Evolve Through Fire, Language, Beauty and Time, which is out now in the UK from Allen Lane. Gaia, thank you so much for coming in and telling us about it.
Thanks for having me.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, edited by Sky Redman, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89UP and hosted by Acast. If you enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, rate us on iTunes, and even tell a friend. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.